And I said, well, hang on, Bill. Until you came along with the Gates Foundation, governments were pouring money into aid for malaria and getting nowhere.
Everything's getting better. Let nobody tell you that the second decade of the 21st century has been bad. The astonishing feature of the United Kingdom's overbearing sense of gloom is that it is totally detached from measurable economic factors in the real world. Shouldn't we instead be in a celebratory mood, bursting with optimism and with hope? Instead, we are the equivalent of fans of a football team on a wonderful run of form who seem permanently convinced that the next match will result in crushing defeat. Of course, the doomsayers say that the past results are no guarantee of future performance, and they're technically correct in that assertion, but the past does surely act as a reasonable guide, and it's worth us being aware of. Now, today's guest on the IEA podcast has recently argued that we are living through the greatest improvement in human living standards in history. Extreme poverty has fallen below 10% of the world's population for the first time. It was 60% when he was born. Global inequality has been plunging as Africa and Asia experience faster economic growth than Europe and North America. Child mortality has fallen to record low levels. Famine virtually went extinct. Malaria, polio, and heart disease are all in decline. The size of the world economy grew by over a third in the past decade and now stands at more than $86 trillion. If anything, this upward trend is showing signs of accelerating. World GDP can reasonably be expected to surpass $100 trillion before the next decade is out. Now, Matt Ridley, today's guest, his books have sold over a million copies and have been translated into 31 languages and won several awards. His books include The Red Queen, The Origins of Virtue, Genome, Nature via Nurture, Francis Crick, The Rational Optimist, and The Evolution of Everything. His TED Talk, When Ideas Have Sex, has been viewed more than 2 million times. He writes a weekly column in The Times and writes regularly for The Wall Street Journal. First of all, hi Matt, thank you very much for joining me today.
Morning Darren, it's great to talk to you.
Now, Matt, you only have to have a quick scroll through the papers today and they're discussing air pollution that could kill 160,000 people in the next decade, California's wildfire risk and a decade of blackouts, as well as a UN draft plan with a 2030 target to avert Earth's sixth mass extinction. That doesn't all sound terribly great, does it?
It's fascinating how the papers more and more concentrate on the bad news. They always have. Good news is no news. But actually, you know, those very headlines disguise some pretty remarkable things that are going on. So, for example, the amount of air pollution is declining. Nobody seems to know that. Everyone thinks it's getting worse. It's not. It's getting better. It's getting better in terms of almost all the measures you can think of, you know, particulate matter, nitrogen oxides, sulfur dioxide, all these, carbon monoxide, they're all improving. They have been steadily for a very long time. What is true is that they haven't declined as fast as they would have done if we hadn't all gone over to diesel vehicles. Yeah. And we did that because the environmentalists told us to. Mm-hmm. So there is actually an issue there. And of course, we have reset the levels lower and lower at what we say is, quote, illegal levels of air pollution, so that we're constantly breaking them still, which is, in a sense, a measure of how well we're doing, because we keep setting ourselves more and more ambitious targets for cleaner air, and we keep meeting them. The air is far, far cleaner than it was in the 1980s or 1970s or 1960s, particularly the 1950s, when pea soup fogs were common in London. Just to take another of those things, which is the biodiversity crisis, nobody knows that extinction rates have fallen in the last few decades. They were higher in the 1960s than they are today, and they were higher in the 1900s than they were in the 1960s. They then went down, then went up again, then went down again, as far as we can tell. And of course, we can't measure every extinction, but we're pretty sure about the birds, mammals, and most of the other vertebrates that we know roughly how many are going extinct. Now, that's because of conservation efforts. We've lost in the last 500 years about 1.5% of birds and mammals from the world. That's a pity. A lot of them are wonderful creatures that it'd be great not to have lost, the dodo, the great auk, things like that. But actually, we were told by environmentalists in the 1970s that we were going to lose between 50 and 75% of all birds and mammals by 2000. And here we are 20 years later with a very low extinction rate, thanks to the efforts of conservationists. You know, let's be honest, you know, it does work, conservation. And I think we've got to start giving young people particularly a sense of what can be achieved rather than a council of despair.
And does it concern you, though, that the deforestation, which is still happening at what many readers or listeners would consider to be at an alarming pace, and you lose that rich diversity that's common in the Amazon, for example, with all of those species facing potential extinction, does that not concern you?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. I'm someone who worked on wildlife conservation projects professionally in my youth, in India and Pakistan mainly, in the early 1980s, trying to help endangered species and endangered habitats. And deforestation is a big part of that problem. Again, it's one that was much worse then than it is now. Mm-hmm. Total global deforestation has now reversed. There are several studies showing this, that on the whole we're adding forest to the planet every year. Most of that is natural regeneration. It's not plantations, which are less biodiverse. More of it is in the north and in rich countries than in the south and in poor countries. And that's a pity, because it's the tropics where we'd really like to get it back, because, as you say, they're much more biodiverse. But the general rule is that, and Jesse Auserbel discovered this, is that when a country passes about $5,000 a year GDP per capita, it stops deforesting and starts reforesting. So Bangladesh has passed that level and has been adding forest for some time now. So in other words, this is a problem caused by poverty, not wealth, mm-hmm. not prosperity, not capitalism. It's caused by too much poverty, because when people are poor, they go into the woods and cut down the trees to make firewood over which to cook, or they unleash their goats into the woodlands, which destroy the regeneration of forests and so on. So there are many parts of the world that are seeing tropical forest regeneration on a spectacular scale, places like Costa Rica, for example. And yes, this is secondary forest, not the primary rainforest. But within a surprisingly short time, scientists now reckon, it's showing huge diversity again. So these ecosystems can be healed and are being healed, and we're seeing a net increase in forest now in the world, which is an extraordinary thing to have achieved when mm-hmm. you think how where we were at 40 or 50 years ago with rapid deforestation happening everywhere. We've got a long way to go till we get back to the amount of forest that was there before humans started cutting it down, but we're heading in the right direction.
And you focus there on the fact that with prosperity, or relative prosperity compared to what people used to be living like and their living situation was, comes a refocusing on other priorities, like reforestation, for example. So does it therefore concern you that we're seeing the rejection of free trade and globalization that could continue throughout the next decade?
I am very worried about that. On the whole, I'm not pessimistic about the world, but one thing I do get pessimistic about is that we are trying to kill the goose that lays the golden mm-hmm. eggs, because it's very clear that what solves these problems is the experimentation and innovation that comes with free markets and free enterprise. This is clear not only on the sort of micro level, if you look at the ecological devastation of North Korea versus South Korea, of Eastern Europe versus Western Europe, you know, that communism does a terrible job of looking after the environment, because nobody has skin in the game, nobody has a vested interest in improving the environment, and you don't get the innovation that you need to wean people off dependence on natural environments and, on the whole, go over to, you know, eating farmed animals rather than wild animals, and burning, using electricity and gas rather than chopping down trees to make energy. You know, these are the changes that are brought about by free markets and free enterprise. But you also see this much more generally on the sort of large scale, that where you want to solve environmental problems, it's vital to include people who live there in solving the problem. You mm-hmm. can't do it by government diktat. Mm-hmm. You have to have buy-in, skin in the game, by local people. And the way to do that is to harness this extraordinary thing called the market, where we all work for each other and we all have a vested interest in looking after the sources of our prosperity. And actually, you know, this works. If you look at Africa, for example, large parts of southern Africa have now been taken away from cattle and given back to wildlife. Why is that happening? Because basically wildlife pays better than cattle. How does it pay better? Not for photographic safaris, because on the whole, the tourists tend to only go to the few hotspots, the major national parks, but for hunting safaris. So trophy hunting, Professor Adam Hart at Bristol University has shown this very clearly, actually, has written about this. Trophy hunting has been a huge fillip to the restoration of wildlife in southern Africa. Marketing these animals and the money from the hunting of them, and, you know, they're going to die anyway, as it were, so it's just a question of whether you allow human beings to be one of the predators that takes them alongside lions and other things. That money is ploughed back into the community, into local communities, and does a power of good, and is looking after wildlife. So if we ban the import of trophies, as we're about to do in this country, we will probably send the wrong signal to the market in southern Africa and say, well, actually, maybe we should go back to having cattle. Let's get rid of the buffaloes and the antelopes and the lions and the tigers. Not tigers, sorry, they're in India.
I wonder, if we look closer to home, a lot of the focus seems to be on this idea that the last decade paved the way for a new normal. And that new normal is one of insecure employment, whether that be through more flexible working hours and working relationships with your employer, and poorly paid employment at that, you know, that decade of austerity that you often hear about. Do you recognise that?
Well, I think in the UK, it is true that we've had a decade of low growth and we've had a decade of stagnant productivity, and that is a real concern. Why is that? It's gone alongside a decade of spectacular employment, in the sense that more people are in work than ever before, a greater percentage of the workforce is, there's very low unemployment. It's on the whole possible to get a job, if you want one, pretty well anywhere in the country now, with some small exceptions. That's pretty remarkable when you think where we came from at the beginning of the decade, plunged into a very deep recession that many thought was the beginning of a Great Depression, and that looked like it was going to lead to a collapse in world trade, and the sort of genuine poverty that we hadn't seen since the 1930s or so. That didn't happen. We got people back into work, and we got, on the whole, a relatively stable and increasing income for most people. But nothing like as fast as we've managed in previous decades. Mm-hmm. Why is that? What's gone wrong? You know, why can't we get the motor turning faster? And it may be something to do with the cheapness of money, which has kept sort of zombie firms alive and that sort of thing. So you're not getting the natural turnover to new businesses that are more productive. It may be something to do with the increasing regulation that makes it very hard to innovate. Apart from in the digital area, innovation has been pretty stagnant in recent decades, and that's a real concern, because that's where prosperity comes from, is innovation. And it may be something to do with the fact that the rest of the world is catching up and is selling us goods, and so it's tough to keep manufacturing here. We've driven up the price of energy spectacularly in the UK in the last 10 years, particularly for business, and that has driven a lot of well-paid jobs abroad, and will continue to do so. We've done that deliberately in an attempt to try and switch to low carbon energy, but it has a cost. It definitely does. There are many factors behind this. It would be nice to try and unleash Britain's potential, In my view, one of the biggest things we can do is just to stop people preventing innovation.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever somebody comes along with a new idea, whether it's vaping or genetically modified crops or gene editing or something, you suddenly start hearing from all the people who think this might be a bad idea. And on the precautionary principle, we suddenly put in place a huge number of regulations that make it very difficult to do. Fracking is another example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So do you think global economic growth has benefited transnational corporations off of the backs of the poorest around the world?
Clearly not. Global economic growth has benefited the poorest the most. If you look at the proportion of the rewards that go to, as it were, the big businessmen rather than ordinary people, consumers particularly, but also workers, they're the same people, of course, then the vast majority of it has gone to ordinary people. The percentage of the world population that lives in extreme poverty has halved in the past decade. It's now below 10%. It was something like 60% when I was born. That's extraordinary. No human being has ever lived through a transition like that. And it's by far the biggest news of the decade, the lifting out of poverty, of extreme poverty. That's $1.90 a day. You know, that's unbelievable poverty. The lifting out of poverty of billions of people has been happening over the last few decades, mainly in China, partly in India, mostly in Asia, increasingly in Africa. Africa is now seeing the kind of levels of economic growth that Asia saw a generation before, and that many people said, when I was writing my book, The Rational Optimist, 10 years ago, people were telling me, yeah, it'll work in Asia, but it won't work in Africa. Nonsense. It's now happening in Africa. You're seeing a tech revolution. You're seeing prosperity. You're seeing agriculture developing. You're seeing people moving into cities and getting better paid jobs. You're seeing fewer wars and less violence and much, much less disease. Malaria and HIV in particular, there's been spectacular progress against. So Africa is the poorest continent, and it has a long way to go, but it is showing signs of remarkable and rapid improvement. That's coming about because of the operation of free markets and businesses. To the extent that big business lobbies government for privileges and against its own competitors, I think the critics have a point, a very good point, because actually when you look at it, quite a lot of big business, business on the whole helps people, as I've just said, but quite a lot of big business then becomes quite protective of its own vested interests and gets in the way of innovation and competition. And we need to be very careful about that, because the transnational, multinational corporations have got quite good at a somewhat complacent way of running the world to their own advantage.
And Davos immediately springs to mind.
Certainly does.
Yes,
and
yeah.
Funnily enough, my invitation hasn't arrived. I've been there once, a long, long time ago.
Was it as bad as they say?
It was pretty ghastly.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. I can imagine. Now, I was listening to Fraser Nelson, the editor of The Spectator, on the BBC, no less. They allowed him, Radio 4 allowed him to do an entire programme on this very topic, on the human progress that we've seen over the past decade.
I keep meaning to listen to it, and
it was very good,
yes.
Very good. And he was discussing that as a former financial journalist. He has collected a lot of data over his career. And often in doing so, he was looking to prove just how bad things were. Because like you said, papers have to sell. And in order to sell, the most damning story they can paint will shift the biggest amount of papers. But to his amazement, the figures often show time and time again the reverse story. If you look at air quality, which you've mentioned, lots of scientists and campaigners have argued that air quality should be a great priority for this new government. But the funny thing is that it's never been better in our lifetimes. And that's what you call the paradox of progress. As things improve, people can pay for them to get better still. But the headlines always paint them as being pretty bad. And that conceals the fact that things are actually going really, really rather well.
We have a tendency to bank progress, to take it for granted, to say, fine, okay, you've made the world better. Why don't you make it better still? Which is, in a way, quite healthy.
Yes.
You know, it keeps pressure on people to do things. This is well expressed in, you know, the first world problem mm-hmm. concept, you mm-hmm. know. I can't get a signal on my phone. I'm in a tunnel going at 200 miles an hour and I'm not getting a signal on my phone. Well, aren't you quite glad that it's even possible to mm-hmm. use a mobile mm-hmm. phone at all?
Yeah.
So we never look back and say, wow, wasn't that great? We just say, ugh, why isn't it better?
Are there any stats that have particularly floored you that you've looked into and thought?
I tell you, one of the really interesting ones is, I think, the safety of air travel. In the 1970s, there were about 3,000 fatalities per 1,000 revenue passenger kilometres, okay?
Okay,
right. So for every 1,000 kilometres that a passenger travelled, as it were, you know, per passenger, I mean, over all the passengers, there were about 3,000 deaths. It's a very small number, mm-hmm. actually. You know, most people didn't die of crashes. Do you know what that number was in 2018?
No.
It was 59.
Wow.
Actually, that might have been 2017, but anyway. You know, from 3,000 to 59, it is unbelievably mm-hmm. difficult to be killed in an airplane. Mm-hmm. Much, much easier to be killed on the road. And those 59... well, I don't know whether they did. Depends which year we're talking about, but you know that's the sort of scale we're seeing. And of course, this year we've had a Ukrainian
yes.
airliner crash, we've had the two Boeing Max crashes of the last couple of years, which were shocking events caused by a badly designed automation system within Boeing in an airplane that was designed to save fuel and was therefore rather unstable to fly and therefore had to have a computer flying. So there's an element of this coming out of the desire to be more efficient with mm-hmm. fuel and so on. But those have had huge attention. An airplane crash gets far more attention than it did 30, 40 years ago. Because it's so rare.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the paradoxes.
Yes.
Professor Daniel Gilbert at Harvard University calls this prevalence-induced concept change. Once something gets rare, we start to notice it more, and we even redefine things so as to sort of keep seeing them. I mean, his classic example is he tells people to press a button whenever he sees a blue dot, and after a bit he makes blue dots really rare, and they start pressing a button when they see purple dots, saying, well, that's sort of blue.
Right.
And we sort of do the same in this. Well, it's not the same with passenger air crashes, but, you know, there are other examples where we say, well, okay, but let's expand the definition of hate crime or whatever it might mm-hmm. be as it gets rarer, so as to keep making sure that we get lots of
mm-hmm.
it. I think that's a very striking statistic. But the other really big one is child mortality. Child mortality is the biggest measure of misery I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's anything that I can think of that's worse than a child dying for a parent and for the child. And fewer and fewer people experience that. On all continents, it's coming down. And it's coming down particularly fast in Africa at the moment, which is great because it stalled in Africa in the 80s and 90s. I mean, the graph shows this very clearly. Other continents still have declining child mortality. In Africa, it doesn't decline, it levels out. And the reason it leveled out at that point was because of the HIV epidemic. And very interestingly, the New York Times actually dug up a story about this in about 20 years ago. When it started to improve again, some journalists wanted to write about this and were lobbied hard by a pressure group not to. You know, don't tell this good news. We're trying to get more money out of the government for this.
Mm-hmm,
this
mm-hmm.
is the kind of thing that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
That actually people have a vested interest in pessimism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to get child mortality down to the levels we've got it down to, you know, in very poor countries now have extremely low levels of child mortality, much lower than we had when we were somewhat richer in the West.
To what extent that you mentioned there, there's a real desire to push the really good good or negative stats, but surely there's a desire for developing countries to push good stats and maybe inflate good stats to point out the fact that maybe aid budgets are having the desired effect in order to receive more funds from Western governments. Do you think there's ever...
Well, no, I think...
Can we trust the data, I'm basically asking?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think on the whole, in competition for aid, people like to paint as bleak a picture as they can of their own situation so as to get more aid. I had a very interesting argument with Bill Gates once about this, where he was lambasting the British... one part of the British media for arguing that our aid target should be changed because the 0.7% of GDP going to aid was a mistake. And I think it is a mistake because we don't know what GDP is, so we have to scramble around at the end of the year and make sure that we've given enough or take some back if we've given too much. It's crazy to link it to GDP in that way. But that wasn't his point. His point was that, you know, it's morally imperative for a country like Britain to give as much as it can in aid to the developing world. And I said, well, hang on, Bill. Until you came along with the Gates Foundation, governments were pouring money into aid for malaria and getting nowhere. Malaria was getting worse. Malaria mortality was increasing up until about the year 2003. It's then plummeted since then. What happened in 2003? The Gates Foundation started pushing the insecticide-treated bed net as a simple, low-cost solution to malaria, which was based on some experiments that had been done which showed that it was both a deterrent and a way of preventing mosquitoes. And so Gates comes along and shows government how they should have been doing it.
Mm-hmm.
All these years. They'd frittered away our money for decades. And Gates shows, no, actually, do you know what? If you choose the right technology and you push it in the right way and you don't spend it all on white consultants, you know, in suits, you actually get it to the people who matter, then you can make a difference. So far from his foundation showing the importance of aid, his foundation shows the importance of not relying on government for aid. And I think, that was quite a cunning way of picking a fight with him, because I was both complimenting him and arguing back against him, and it did shut him up for about 5 seconds.
What do you think explains the powerful effect of the optimism gap? Because if you ask people questions about their own lives, for example, how safe is your neighbourhood, how good is your kid's school, how happy are you, what do you think your economic prospects are in the next few years? They're generally quite optimistic.
Yes.
But if you ask them the same questions about their country, then all of a sudden they turn into, the schools don't teach any kids anything, the streets are unsafe, the economy's going to the sewer, everyone else around me is absolutely miserable. You know, have you found this? And two, what do you think explains it?
Yes, this is a very striking effect, that personal optimism contrasted with general pessimism. And the bigger the picture you ask people to look at, the more pessimistic they are. I mean, they're really pessimistic about the planet, quite pessimistic about their country, a little pessimistic about their town, and not at all pessimistic about their family. They're optimistic. In fact, they're too optimistic. People think they're going to live longer than they do. They think they're going to stay married longer than they do. They think they're better drivers than they are. You know, there's all sorts of sort of ways in which people deceive themselves into thinking everything's fine when in some ways it isn't. This is a very striking phenomenon. It seems to be inherent in human nature. Steven Pinker's written about this quite a lot. It's sort of part of the fact that we don't, you know, we're much more censorious and judgmental about other people. We think other people are running the world, whereas we're running our own lives, as it were. There's something there involved in it, and apart from pointing it out, I don't know how one sort of combats it. And of course, it's relatively healthy. I mean, it would be better than the other way around. If people were constantly pessimistic about their own lives but complacent about the fate of the planet, maybe that would be a worse situation. I don't know. It is getting more and more striking, and of course the media is feeding it more and more. So I think this contrast is something that we have to just be aware of. And you know, the main thing is just to get young people aware of this. Most young people think that the environmental Armageddon, that they think they are facing is a new idea. Well, come back to the 1970s with me and listen to what the grown-ups told me about the future then. And it was even worse. The population explosion was unstoppable. Our lifespan was going to get shorter because of pollution. We were going to run out of food. We were going to run out of oil. We were going to lose all the rainforest. The deserts were advancing. You know, it just went on and on and on. The catalogue of, you know, the outlook for man is bleak, said Robert Heilbronner in a bestseller in about 1970. Even Money says Britain will not exist except as an impoverished swamp, said Paul Ehrlich. You know, these were...
Well, they're sort of Attenborough-esque calls to cull the population.
Absolutely. Mm. And they resulted in some extremely inhumane policies in India and in China. You know, a lot of the sterilisation done in India was done at the effectively the point of a gun. A lot of the one-child policy in China, which was done, funnily enough, not under Mao, but under Deng Xiaoping, was... extremely inhumane. If you made the mistake of having two children, you know, your whole village was punished, and, you know, not just economically, but you were, you know, people were jailed and things like that, you know. So there was really brutal policies. And by the way, the evidence suggests that China's fertility rate was declining slightly faster before that policy was brought in than after. So it didn't even have the desired effect.
I mean, that's truly astounding. But I think a really good example of this sort of detachment from what's actually happening. If you take the River Thames, and you know we're sat not too far from it, it's around the corner. A river that has now got used to having, well, or had got used to having no fish at all in it because it was too polluted.
Yes.
Now I think has up to 50 species of fish in it.
Is that right?
I've heard
something similar. I don't know the number, but
I think it's up to 50. But I read that and I thought that is incredible.
Yeah. No, it is. What we've done to our rivers is extraordinary. I mean, I live near the River Tyne, as do you.
Yeah.
And when I was young, no salmon could run the Tyne because it was too polluted in the estuary. Now it's the best salmon river in England. It's got otters back.
I didn't know
it's
that got, actually.
Yes, it is. It's got otters back. It's got you know, a lot of fish-eating birds and things like gooseanders and herons and things are there in good numbers. It's really spectacular how that's improved. And I didn't see that coming. I mean, when I was young, I thought, oh yeah, pollution just gets worse and worse as we get richer and richer. It's not true. It actually gets better and better as we get richer and richer.
So do you think then the Greta Thunberg generation will grow up, you know, reach a ripe old age and think, you know what, things have actually been quite decent?
Well, I'm desperate to live long enough to say I told you so on this. And I'm sure I won't, but...
I'm sure you will.
Because... you know, if we get to 2050 and we've had mild warming, yes, that has caused some problems somewhere and a retreat of Arctic ice and a slight rise in sea level, etc. But on the whole, we haven't had a mass extinction of species. We haven't had a collapse of agriculture. We haven't had a people eating their own children to stay alive at all, whatever it is that Extinction Rebellion tells us is about to happen. Then at some point... And I reckon we're 30 years into this global warming scare, and already it's nothing like as bad as we were told it was going to be in 1990. They deny that. They say, oh, yes, it's worse. But it's not. It really isn't. I mean, they were forecasting 0.3 degrees per decade in 1990. We haven't had anything like that. We've had about half that, slightly less than half.
You know, right now, someone would come running up to you with a sheet showing temperature rises in Australia since 1900.
Yeah. The temperature's going up. We're in a period of global warming. It's man-made. Yeah, duh. Mm-hmm. Of course the temperature's going up. That's the whole idea.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't that be happening? But the question is how much and how fast.
Yeah.
And if we get to 2050, 2060, and actually the world is better, we're using less land to feed more people, so we've got bigger nature reserves, we've got mass reforestation, we've got species back, we've even de-extinguished some species. That's a project that I'm slightly involved in and very excited by, using genetic technologies to go and get the dodo back or the mammoth back. You know, why not? If we've got that situation, I will be there saying, I told you so. But I'm pretty sure that the young people of the day will be being told that it's all about to go horribly wrong.
Yes.
Why do I think that? Because I've gone as far back as I can go, and people are always saying, 500 years ago, 100 years ago, are saying, actually, it's gone quite well till now, but it's about to go horribly wrong. I call this turning point-itis.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a wonderful quote from Lord Macaulay in 1830. He was reviewing a gloomy book by Robert Southey saying this industrial revolution is a bad idea. And Macaulay says, on what principle is it that with nothing but improvement behind us, we're to expect nothing but deterioration before us?
I like that. I wonder to what extent, if we think about all of the progress that we've spoken about thus far, do you think that people drawing attention to it, often in these newspapers that we've criticised, campaigning on these issues, highlighting those bad things might have actually had quite positive consequences? Because would that progress have happened without highlighting the issues themselves? Or do you think they actually hinder progress more than they... Does that make sense?
Yes, no, it's a perfectly fair question. And clearly, in some cases, yes. I mean, for example, in the species conservation issues that we talked about, if you draw attention to the fact that a species is about to go extinct, like, say, the bald ibis in North Africa, then people rush out and they grab the last few bald ibises and take them to a zoo and make sure they're okay, and then gradually reintroduce them to the wild, and the population is now thriving again. So, yes, drawing attention to bad news can be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
On the whole, though, what we keep getting is a council of despair. Don't you dare say this problem is soluble. I mean, if let's say we crack fusion energy tomorrow so that a device the size of this tiny room we're in can supply a whole town with energy indefinitely using a small amount of hydrogen. Basically, it's tritium, but it's derived from hydrogen, from helium actually, but it's, you know, it's a form of hydrogen. Can supply the energy of a small town indefinitely from a device the size of this room pretty well forever. And that all we have to do is roll these things off the production line. We can have as much energy as we want in the form of electricity and do whatever we like with it. It's zero carbon, so that's not an issue. It uses extraordinarily few resources. The fuel is very limited. You don't need very much of it. Which, by the way, I think that will happen in about 10 to 20 years. I think we're a lot closer now than we thought we were going to be. But it's not there yet. It's not going to happen tomorrow. But let's imagine it does happen tomorrow. Do you think the environmentalists would say, oh, great, so we can use as much energy as we want. We can stop worrying about foreign holidays and things like that because we can make fuel using this power. It doesn't have any carbon implications. How we're going to do that, I haven't worked out, but, you know, we can do it. Of course not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They would say, but the whole point is I want to force austerity on people. I hate the fact that people are enjoying themselves. I hate the fact that people go on holidays. You know, that's the motivation of a lot of these environmental pressure groups.
And it's the clearest route to a command economy, isn't it, for them to argue for it, in favour of it?
Well, that is, of course, true,
yeah.
Is that, and an awful lot of them are very explicit about this. I mean, Greta Thunberg has been explicit about this, so has Extinction Rebellion, that actually this isn't about just saving the planet. This is about changing the human economic system so that it's properly managed in a way that is not allowed to be free market. It's not bottom up, but it's top down.
So Steven Pinker, you did mention him earlier, he did point out that it's essential to realise that progress doesn't mean that everything gets better for everyone, everywhere, all the time. That
absolutely
would be a
true.
Miracle. That wouldn't be progress.
Yes, exactly. And that's absolutely true. But you know, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying, so I quite often in an interview like this get confronted with a fact, well, hang on, what about X?
Yes,
that's
yes.
getting worse.
Yeah.
And I say, well, yeah, it is, fine. You know, some things get worse. So, for example, the suicide rate in the United States has been going up for the last 3 years. Not in the world. The world suicide rate's going down, but in the United States it's ticked up. I was confronted by that on a radio station. I didn't know it. I went back and checked the numbers. Well, it has gone up, but from a very, very low level. It's nothing like as high as it was 20 years ago, but it's ticked up a bit. It's probably something to do with the opioid epidemic.
Yeah,
it's not a good thing, but that it's not the end of the world. I mean, it is for individual people, but it's not, you know, for it doesn't mean that that everything else is going wrong. I do think that one has to get these things in perspective.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, Matt, I wonder if to end you could set out how this country would arguably, I think, be an even better place to live in the 2020s if we started to think a bit more rationally about the wonderful new opportunities, technological breakthroughs, and increased wealth that will come, rather than talking ourselves into a state of misery and fearing the worst.
If we could get the growth rate up sustainably and non-inflationarily to 3 or 4% a year, it would have a spectacular effect on living standards in this country, because it would generate far more public funds for hospitals, schools, and so on, as well as, of course, generating much more private wealth, which would be spread, could be spread very evenly, as long as we free up things like housing, which is a big cause of inequality at mm-hmm. the moment.
Yeah.
Our policies on housing, I should say. Just imagine if we had, you know, a decade of 3 or 4% of growth instead of a decade of 1 or 2% of growth. It's a miracle, really, the difference. I'm not asking for 8 or 9% like the tiger economies had in their heyday, and some African economies are experiencing nowadays. But we could do that. We could do that if we unleash innovation, if we allow people to change things, if we speed up the regulatory system. I mean, it's spectacular how slow it is to get permission to do something in this mm-hmm. country from the planning system or other regulators. There is absolutely no haste, no hurry, no incentive for bureaucrats and civil servants to speed things up. There is a huge bias against the new and in favour of the old on behalf of complacent businesses. We could have technologies that we can't even dream of, particularly in the biomedical area, where we're pretty good in this country, but we could be even better. It takes far longer to register a new medical device in this country than it does in the United States, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we could, you know, just a simple thing. At the moment, we're not winning the battle against ill health in old age. People are living longer, but they're getting ill for longer as well. Imagine if you could crack that, if you could develop some of these senolytic medications that would actually crack the problem of aging itself, that would actually stop you, your cells aging, so you spend a longer time living but a shorter time dying. You know, you got to 90 and you were fine, but then you had just a couple of years of ill health before you died, instead of, say, 15 or 20 years of ill health before you died. That would transform people's lives. It would also save a lot of money. Let's be ambitious. Let's have a go at that kind of thing. And the one great thing we've got going for us at the moment is that we have a Prime Minister who gets this.
Well, Matt, I hope this sets the tone for the rest of this upcoming decade. Thank you very much for joining the IEA today.
Thanks, Darren.
You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Podbean. And you can find IEA reports, blogs, and films on our website, iea.org.uk.